When last we left Saul and David, things were not good. But don't worry, they're about to get worse. We are on chapter 24, the first book of Samuel. And David and Saul are doing this quasi-homicidal dance in the wilderness, where Saul is alternately threatening and then and David escapes, and then Saul repents, and then he threatens again. So we are now in the wilderness of Ein Gedi, which any of you who have ever visited Israel may remember. It's a place they still take people. It's one of those places that is continuous with the biblical name. So there are other places that they'll tell you that they'll take you to this or that site, but they don't know for sure that it's the same place that was identified by that name in the Bible, but certain topographical features convince everybody that the Ein Gedi of today is the Ein Gedi of chapter 24. When Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, because remember he was called away at the last minute, saving David's life by the Philistines. It was like the opposite of the cavalry. The cavalry are the good guys who come and save you. The Philistines were the bad guys who came and saved David. Although obviously we think they're the bad guys. If we had the Philistine Bible, they would see it differently. But the poor Philistines don't get a voice, so who knows? So Saul took 3,000 picked men from all Israel and went in search of David and his men. In the direction of the rocks of the wild goats, as it says at the bottom, the meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain, but again, it's in En Gedi, and he came to the sheepfolds along the way. There was a cave there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the back of the cave. Yesterday I had a phone conversation with a guy whose name escapes me for a moment, Mark something, who produces like American Idol and other things, and who is producing and has already finished a series of Bible dramatizations that he's going to show, Old and New Testament, or Hebrew Bible and New Testament, that they are going to be shown, I think, on the History Channel, and his intention is to try to make it, you know. He said that, you know, he talks about how abominable biblical literacy is in the United States, and he thought maybe if he dramatized some Bible stories, it would get people aware and talking about it. And he has a few of them are on the Hebrew Bible, and some of them are on the New Testament. And I think Survivor is the other show he does. He does like two big reality shows.
Mark Burnett?
Yes. There you go. Thank you. That was his name. It probably still is. So, it wasn't that long a conversation. But he was talking about the challenges that they faced and the difficulties they encountered in doing all this. And he said the other thing is, and he gave me some very funny examples about how low biblical literacy is, but he said, and the other thing is that when you actually do quote the Bible, people don't believe it. He says, when I tell people about the story of Saul went out to urinate and David was in the cave, they say, come on. And I say, look it up. It's actually there. Because it sounds like it's so implausible. And because people obviously, even though everybody has an impression of what the Bible's about, their actual knowledge of the Bible is considerably less than what it is they generally assume. But in fact, that's exactly what happened, that coincidentally, or by God's design, or whatever, Saul and David find themselves in the same cave, engaged in different activities. So David's men said to him, this is the day which the Lord has said to you, I will deliver your enemy into your hands. You can do with him as you please. So it's true, he could kill Saul easily now, although David is smarter than his enemies here, because killing Saul and having it be known that David killed Saul would actually not be a good start to his kingship. And if he did that, if he didn't show himself to be more flexible which is what, you know, that even though Saul wants to kill him, he still has respect for him, it would send all of ancient Israel off the fiscal cliff. So flexibility is the issue. But afterwards, thank you. I just thought I'd slip it in and see if anybody was awake at 8:30 in the morning. So instead, David went and stealthily cut off the corner of Saul's cloak. Now, I suppose it is possible that if Saul is standing there and urinating, that there's time both to have the dialogue and then for David to go over and cut his coat and for Saul not to notice. It stretches credulity a little bit. It's also pretty hard to, you know, it's like the skill of a pickpocket, I suppose. But even there, what a pickpocket does is bump into you so that you feel something, but you don't realize what the... But anyway, whatever the exact sequence is, the idea is, obviously, that David could have killed him, didn't kill him, and wants evidence that he could have killed him and didn't kill him. It's not just that he wants to say, by the way, you know, I was in that cave, and Saul will go, right. But he wants evidence that actually he could have killed Saul and chose not to. Now, does he want that evidence for Saul? Maybe, partly, but he also wants that evidence for Israel to prove that he's upright because he knows that he's going to inherit the kingship, and if he's not responsible for Saul's death, he's going to have a much better and much easier time, although, as you will see, not an easy time. But afterward, David reproached himself for cutting off the corner of Saul's cloak. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid I should do such a thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, that I should raise my hand against him, for he's the Lord's anointed." David rebuked his men and didn't permit them to attack Saul. So here's a side of David that is improbable, and that is that he even feels bad about cutting off Saul's coat because he feels as though he's violated the sanctity of the king. And so he gets upset with himself and with his men that they were contemplating killing Saul. Saul left the cave and started on his way. Then David also went out of the cave and called after Saul, "My lord king." Saul looked around, and David bowed low in homage with his face to the ground. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to people who say David is out to do you harm? You can see for yourself now that the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave today. And though I was urged to kill you, I showed pity for you. For I said, I will not raise my hand against my Lord, since he's the Lord's anointed. Please, sir, take a close look at the corner of your cloak in my hand. For when I cut off the corner of your cloak, I didn't kill you. You must see plainly that I've done nothing evil or rebellious and never wronged you. Yet you are bent on taking my life." Now, first of all, obviously the Saul has a distinctive cloak as the king. Otherwise, he could say, oh, anybody could have that piece of fabric in their hand. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may he take vengeance upon you for me, but my hand will never touch you. Now, that's a significant comment, obviously. It isn't that David doesn't want Saul to die, right? At this point, he's pretty fed up, and he does want Saul to die, but he's not going to do it. And also, it could also be, this is a slightly cynical reading, but not an improbable one, that, you know, people have a deep, even today, a deep faith/superstition about the power of words. You might think it doesn't mean anything if someone curses you, but you still don't like to hear somebody curse you. And you still wonder, you know, like, does that have any effect? And if David knows either that Saul will die or that David will arrange for him to die in a way that will not implicate David, having said earlier, "May God arrange for you to die," would not be a bad thing to say, because now it's in people's minds that maybe God will arrange for Saul to die, and then later if Saul dies, the implication will be it was God and not David who did this. So for all those reasons, it's strategically wise for David to say, "I want God to kill you, even though I'm not going to do it." As the ancient proverb has it, Wicked deeds come from wicked men. My hand will never touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea? May the Lord be arbiter, and may he judge between you and me. May he take note and uphold my cause and vindicate me against you. Again, we don't know what the original, like if that was a proverb as well, but the idea is pretty clear, which is David saying, I'm nothing, and you've been chasing me all over the country with all your men trying to kill me, and I'm not going to kill you back because only wicked people do wicked things. By implication, Saul is a wicked person because he's seeking to do a wicked thing. And so you're not only squandering the majesty of the kingship by spending your time pursuing this insignificant person, but also you're doing something that's evil in God's sight, and I hope God strikes you down for it. So the speech accomplishes a lot of things, and again, remember that it's not only Saul who's hearing this. We've got to assume that David is saying this in the hearing of at least his men, and probably some of Saul's men too, because it's unlikely that they would leave him, you know, they're not going to leave him completely alone. Have any of you, probably not, I'm sure, I would guess not, have any of you seen Borgen or know what Borgen is? So this is what comes from reading the New York Times. So the New York Times had this review of a Danish television show called Borgen that's on Link TV. It's all in Danish. It has English subtitles. And it talked about what a wonderful political drama it was and how they were going to have a marathon over Thanksgiving Day where they were going to show all two seasons of Borgen. So if you've got a DVR, right, you can tape all two seasons of Borgen and watch them, you know, for the as long as you want to. So I've watched a couple of episodes of Borgen where there's now a woman prime minister, which is in itself is interesting. And also it's interesting, Borgen means government. Not that I would know, other than the fact that every time they show Borgen, they put in little parentheses government underneath. But here's what I found so interesting was, the drama itself is interesting, and it's interesting to see how much smaller the government is, that it reminds you of Israel. It's like the prime minister lives in her house. Yes, she has a big office, but she goes home to her kids every night. Literally, I mean, to her kids in her house, where she helps them with their homework sometimes, because she's the prime minister of Denmark. And in fact, there's this one episode where something bad, it's complicated, but something bad happens in Greenland, and the prime minister and the American president is about to come to Denmark. And the prime minister of Greenland says, because Denmark sort of pushed them around, he said, don't forget what you are to Greenland, the United States is to you. So it's very, you know. The reason I bring all this up is I said that Saul has someone with him. One of the things that I noticed was when the Danish prime minister drives around, one car follows her. You know, you don't shut down the city of Los Angeles and have helicopters and 30 cars because it's Denmark. And what we think of as government changes so much given the size of the country. And I've heard many times people go to Israel and say it's wonderful how informal Israel is, but it's also a function of size. In a place where you don't have a monarchy and it's a small country, so it doesn't feel like the president is very remote. I mean, there are 6 million people. How many of them went to school with her or know her husband in business or so on? It's such a different attitude. And in a way, it's helpful. In a way, it's helpful to think about this because we're talking about people that all know each other and that, you know, are in a tiny little country. And Saul has probably a couple of people around him, but you can't think of him as the president of the United States. There's nothing like that remoteness or security he's just a guy who has to have more people with swords than the other guy has people with swords. So anyway, that was just, I just thought that would or wouldn't be helpful with, this is the best part of being a rabbi, is you never have to feel like you're wasting your time. I really mean it. I'm totally serious. I could be watching this far, and I'm always thinking, could find its way into a sermon. You never know. I'm not wasting my time, right? Read the comics on Sunday morning. It doesn't mean I'm wasting my time. I could find something in there that I could use. So that's a really nice part of being a rabbi, right? Exactly. It's not. It's also, in some ways, it's also a bad part because you never turn the engine off. That is, you always think everything is for use. Everything. But the good part of it is that you never say, "Can't believe I'm wasting my time with Borgen." Yes, comedians, exactly, the same thing. I think anybody who has to translate the world into words, right? Poets, comedians, performers, does that. So when David finished saying these things to Saul, Saul said, "Is that your voice, my son David?" Which is it's kind of heartbreaking in a way. It's clear that this is not a happy, well guy. And his mood swings are volcanic. And Saul broke down and wept. So he said to David, "You're right, not I, for you've treated me generously, but I've treated you badly." Now, it doesn't feel like this is deception. It feels like Saul is on his way to being a broken man. "Yes, you have just revealed how generously you treated me, for the Lord delivered me into your hands and you did not kill me. If a man meets his enemy, does he let him go his way unharmed? Surely the Lord will reward you generously for what you have done for me this day." Which doesn't, notice he's reversing what David said. David said, "May God kill you." Saul says, "May God reward you. I know that you will become king." It's the first time that Saul has admitted it. "And that the kingship over Israel will remain in your hands. So swear to me by the Lord that you will not destroy my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's house." David swore to Saul, and Saul went home. And David and all his men went to the strongholds. In some ways, the drama between Saul and David is ending, and it's ending because Saul is going to die in battle. But you can see the in Saul's acknowledgement that David won, and David won and knew he would win, and it's one of the things that allowed him to be magnanimous, because the magnanimity of the winner is also an assertion of strength. Right? If as a winner you have to be punitive to your enemies, that's an admission of weakness. If you can be magnanimous to them, it's, "I'm so strong that not only did I beat you, but I can be nice to you now." And so David's kindness to Saul is the final straw that lets Saul know that David's going to be king. Because if he could kill me and didn't, how strong must he be to have enough confidence to not even need to kill me? Because if he was really scared of me, he would have killed me. But he doesn't have to. So he clearly, his strength is infinitely greater than what I could muster, and I'm going to lose, and eventually I'm going to die. All right, let me stop there for a second, because something major is going to happen to David. Yes. Is rather what?
David's relationship to Saul's descendants.
Right, we haven't gotten to it yet, but we will. It's complicated, David's relationship to Saul's descendants. It's going to be complicated in a few different ways. But remember that David's relationship, the reason that Saul says this, is that Saul's descendants will for a long time pose a threat to David's throne. Because they're the heirs. Not only are they the heirs to Saul and therefore have some legitimate claim to the throne, but also because it will never be widely believed among Saul's descendants that David had nothing to do with Saul's death or with Saul's demise or with Saul. So they're going to form, and Saul knows this, a block against David forever, and he just doesn't want his descendants to be wiped out. Okay, chapter 25. You probably forgot about Samuel by now, but... And this is, it's a story of obituaries, which is You know, you read about people being dead who you didn't know were still alive, like Dave Brubeck. Who knew he was still alive? And now he died. So I feel so bad. I didn't even know. But yeah. But anyway, so Samuel dies, which means, by the way, in some ways, that David is free, because Samuel was, after all, the one who anointed him, and he and Saul are the seniors to David, and now he's gone. So Saul really is the only authority left in the land, and David has already overcome that one. And all Israel gathered and made lament for him, and they buried him in Ramah, his home. David went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now, David now, what he needs to do is to start mustering more support and, as you'll see, building wealth. And this is going to be a crucial episode for him to do both those things. There was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. The man was very wealthy. He owned 3,000 sheep and 3,000 goats. At the time, he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, which was an ancient tongue twister. The man's name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. The woman was intelligent and beautiful, but the man, a Calebite, was a hard man and an evildoer. Nabal, by the way, in Hebrew means jerk, basically. It does. Jerk. That's exactly what it means. In fact, Nachmanides has a famous statement, Ramban, that you can be Nabal Birshut HaTorah. You can be a jerk or a boor with the permission of the Torah. In other words, you could follow the laws of the Torah and still be a jerk. So what he's saying is, you know, that your essential character and the way you act towards people can't be governed by law, that it's just too... So David dispatched 10 young men, and David instructed the young men, go up to Carmel. When you come to Nabal, greet him in my name. Say as follows, to life, greetings to you and your household and all that is yours. I hear that you're now doing your shearing. As you know, your shepherds have been with us. We didn't harm them. Nothing of theirs was missing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men and they'll tell you. So receive them graciously, for we've come on a festive occasion. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can. Now, what is he saying here? What he's saying, it seems, is we had some of your men in our power. We didn't hurt them. Give us stuff. It's clothed in very nice words, but that's actually what he's saying, right? Your shepherds were with us. We did not hurt them. You can ask them. We treated them nicely. Give us something. In other words, David's running a protection racket. That's what he's doing. A lot of the modern commentators basically say that, right? And they say that's how you build wealth. If you've got a small mob running around ancient Israel, right, you do one of two things. Either you kill people and take their stuff, which is a very bad way for a king to start, and also presumably not what David would do, presumably, or you do the opposite, which is a lot of dangerous people out there, a lot of bad things could happen, we will protect you. And now that we've protected you, right, exactly, we expect, you know, that when Guido stops by, you'll give him, yeah, exactly, you'll give him a little something. David's young men went and delivered this message to Nabal in the name of David. When they stopped speaking, Nabal answered David's servant, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? Now, why does he say both those things? He says the son of Jesse to indicate to you he knows who David is,
yes.
But he's saying David is nothing, right? To threaten someone like Nabal. There are many slaves nowadays who run away from their masters. Should I then take my bread and my water and the meat that I slaughtered for my own shears and give them to men who come from I don't know where? In other words, I don't even know if these people worked for me once, that David says is. A lot of people who work for other people run away. I'm not going to bother to. So if you ran away to David and he was nice to you, what do I care? It has nothing to do with me. Thereupon David's young men retraced their steps. When they got back, they told him all this, and David said to his men, "Gird on your swords." So, obviously, this "gird your swords" means basically put on your sword, put on the belt that has your scabbard, and put your sword on, get ready for battle. And it's, again, it's clear what David's technique is here and what he's doing and why he's doing it, because Nabal is wealthy. So he assumes that he'll get stuff from him. When Nabal refuses, he's going to try a different tactic. Each girded on his sword. David, too, girded on his sword. About 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. In other words, they guarded David's stuff, which means that he's already accumulated things. First of all, because 200 men's a lot of men to guard this stuff, it must be valuable. But remember, by the way, how many men Saul had with him? 3,000. 3,000. So you see that David really, he was running from Saul because he had a small band, and Saul had effectively an army. 3,000 people in the ancient world is an army. So here's the really interesting part. One of Nabal's young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, that David had sent messengers from the wilderness to greet their master and that he had spurned them. But the men had been very friendly to us, and we were not harmed, nor did we miss anything all the time we went about with them while we were in the open. They were a wall about us by night and by day, all the time we were with them tending the flocks. So consider carefully what you should do, for harm threatens our master and all his household. He's such a nasty fellow that no one can speak to him. So they're characterizing Nabal as not a nice guy and David as a nice guy. And Abigail is, as far as we know, the wife of a wealthy, nasty man. So it is possible that she sees an opportunity here, depending on, you know, right. Abigail quickly got together 200 loaves of bread, 2 jars of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 sa'as of parched corn, 100 cakes of raisins, and 200 cakes of pressed figs. She loaded them on asses and told her young men, "Go on ahead of me and I'll follow you." Which, by the way, was the same technique that Jacob used when he was meeting Esau. Gave him all these gifts to soften him up. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. In part, obviously, because she understands the way the world works and Nabal doesn't. And she at least doesn't want David to come and kill everything in the house and destroy the place and loot the place. And Nabal thinks that he can resist, but she knows that he can't. She was riding on the ass and going down the trail on the hill when David and his men appeared coming down towards her, and she met them. Now, David had been saying, "It was all for nothing I protected that fellow's possessions in the wilderness, and that nothing he owned is missing. He's paid me back evil for good. May God do thus and more to the enemies of David, if by the light of morning I leave a single male of his." So David, in other words, is intending a massacre, right? He's going to kill all the males in Nabal's household because Nabal didn't. When Abigail saw David, she quickly dismounted from the ass and threw herself on the ground before David, bowing to the ground. Prostrate at his feet, she pleaded, "Let the blame be mine, my lord, but let your handmaid speak to you. Hear your maid's plea. Please, my lord, pay no attention to that wretched fellow, Nabal, for he is just what his name says. His name means boar, and he is a boar." Kishmo Kainhu is a well-known Hebrew phrase. He's just like his name, okay? "Your handmaid did not see the young man whom my lord sent. I swear, my lord, as the Lord lives and as you live, the Lord who has kept you from seeking redress by blood with your own hands, let your enemies fall, and all who would harm my lord fare like Nabal." Now, what does that mean, fare like Nabal? So far, nothing has happened to Nabal, as far as we know. "Here is the present which your maidservant has brought to my lord. Let it be given to the young men who are followers of my lord. Please pardon your maid's boldness, for the Lord will grant my lord an enduring house, because my lord is fighting the battles of the Lord, and no wrong is ever to be found in you. And if anyone sets out to pursue you and seek your life, the life of my lord will be bound up in the bundle of life in the care of the Lord, but he will fling away the lives of your enemies as from the hollow of a sling. And when the Lord has accomplished for my lord all the good he has promised you and appointed you ruler of Israel, don't let this be a cause of stumbling and of faltering courage to my lord, that you've shed blood needlessly and that my Lord sought redress with his own hands, and when the Lord has prospered, my Lord, remember your maid. So she says lots of things to him. First of all, she's obviously flattering him and being submissive, but also she knows he's going to be king. How does she know he's going to be king? You can only assume that this was the rumor around the land, and that people know that, and that's one of the reasons why Nabal is not happy about it, because he got wealthy under the kingship of Saul, and he's probably in Saul's a booster of Saul, or at least he's part of the aristocracy, and therefore David is concerned in order to get himself to the position where he can rule. He wants to make allies, or at least to get some of the property of the wealthiest members of Israel, which will diminish Saul's support. But the other part of this is that what she's doing in speaking to him this way is indicating to him subtly that her loyalty is with him and not her husband. And we know David by now, and that also may have its consequences and implications, because he says, when you've prospered, don't forget me. That's how she ends. And we don't know how, I mean, we don't know at what point the transaction occurs, but it does occur, because David says to Abigail, praise be the Lord God of Israel, sent you this day to meet me. And blessed be your prudence, and blessed be you yourself from restraining me from seeking redress in blood by my own hands. This was the political argument that Abigail made to him, which is, if you do this, when you become king, it's going to be a blot on your record. And this is exactly why David didn't kill Saul. So she's restraining him from this, and he realizes that she's right and thanks her for restraining him. Because remember, we're talking about, generally in the ancient world, in the medieval world, we're talking about young men. We're talking about college age and sometimes even high school age men. So if they seem hot-headed, you're not talking about somebody who's, you know, and David is at the beginning of his kingship. You're not talking about somebody who is older and seasoned and so on. Nabal insulted him, and his first reaction is, let's go kill them all. Just like, you know, a good 19-year-old male should do, and she restrains him. She is the civilizing force. She says, for as sure as the Lord God of Israel lives, who's kept me from harming you, had you not come quickly to meet me, not a single male of Nabal's line would have been left by daybreak. So he's also strutting, you know? It's like, good, lucky for you, because I would have killed them all. David then accepted from her what she had brought him, and he said to her, go up to your home safely. See, I have heeded your plea and respected your wish. Now, here's the most interesting part in some ways. When Abigail came home to Nabal, he was having a feast in his house, a feast fit for a king. Nabal was in a merry mood and very drunk. So she didn't tell him anything at all till daybreak the next morning, when Nabal had slept off the wine. His wife told him everything that had happened. His courage died within him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal is dead, he said, praised be the Lord, who championed my cause against the insults of Nabal and held back his servant from wrongdoing. The Lord has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head. David sent messengers to propose marriage to Abigail to take her as his wife. When David's servants came to Abigail at Carmel and told her that David had sent them to her to make her his wife, she immediately bowed low with her face to the ground and said, your handmaid is ready to be your handservant. He's already cold in the grave. It's been an hour and a half. To wash the feet of my Lord's servants. And Abigail rose quickly and mounted an ass with 5 of her maids in attendance, followed David's messengers, and she became his wife. Now David had taken Ahinoam of Jezreel, so both of them became his wives. Saul had given his daughter Michal, David's wife, to Palti, son of Laish, from Galim. Remember, he has Michal, right, but Michal has been reassigned by her father, who no longer wants her to be David's wife, to Palti. We'll see that will have implications later too. but what happened to Nabal? So the description sounds like he has a stroke, right? Which excessive eating and drinking and shock could do.
Poison.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I heard actually, speaking of poison, I was listening to National Public Radio, and see, it wasn't a waste of time. Because, you know, they were going to exhume Arafat's body.
Yes.
So they interviewed this professor whose job it is, he's a forensic scientist. He does exhumations, and they asked him, basically, and he told a great story. I'll tell you what they asked him, and I'll tell you the story he told. They asked him, will they be able to tell if Arafat was poisoned? He said, almost certainly not. He said, you know, Agatha Christie got it right. He said, poison is the hardest thing to detect. And he says, after someone dies, it's certain poisons are virtually impossible to know. He said, and after all this time, he said, it's going to be inconclusive, almost certainly. He said, not certainly, but almost certainly. And then he told, so she said to him at the end of the interview, she said, so what was the most interesting exhumation you ever did? He said, the most interesting one was the first. The first one he ever did was in the mid-90s of Jesse James. And he said, all that were left were bones. But what was interesting was, it was the first time and the only time I've ever exhumed someone where I found him buried face down. And we didn't know why he was buried face down. And when we did some archival research, we found out that that was a practice that they would do with outlaws to show them where they were going.
Oh, interesting.
You're going to hell, yeah. So we're going to bury you face down. Wow. Isn't that great? I mean, great. I thought that was fascinating. I thought that was absolutely, look, he killed a lot of people. He was not a nice man. But I just thought, again, very young man when he, but I just thought that was really interesting. So anyway, so maybe Naval was poisoned, but maybe he was assassinated. Maybe he was killed by one of David's men, and this was the story that they put out, which was when I told him the whole story, I mean, they're not there. Abigail's with him at dinner. She said, you know, he killed over. So there are lots of possibilities. Who knows, but this is one of those instances, and there are many, where David's enemies just mysteriously he has the magic touch, or the opposite of the magic touch. His enemies die, and now why does he marry Abigail? In part because now he's become overnight, a very wealthy man. He is no longer a marauding outlaw. This single incident transforms David's life. Now he's suddenly a wealthy man. He owns land, he owns sheep, he owns cattle. All the things that Nabal had, they all belong to him. He has servants. All of this now is David's. And the fact that David turns from this marauding outlaw to a very wealthy man means that when he comes into the kingship, he's going to have resources. Because it's not like now. It's not as though you become king and then you have the national treasury. Right? We're talking about the ancient world. You have nothing other than what you already have. But once you have money, what can you do? What's the most important use of money for a king? You can pay an army. Yeah. And a king needs an army. But you can't have, I mean, why does he have 400 people around him? Because they trust him as a leader, and because they're going to do things like this small time stuff that they did with Nabal, which is, you know, okay, we'll protect his shepherds and then he'll give us some stuff. He doesn't have to do that anymore. And you'll see that everything changes for David after this, because he was smart enough to arrange for Nabal to have a heart attack or a stroke or whatever. Okay, yeah, go ahead. 1, 2, 3.
If Abigail is a slave girl.
She's not a slave girl. No. She's his wife.
It
says, but a slave girl.
Where?
In this book.
What verse?
Look, your servant is but a slave girl to wash the feet of
No. That she's talking about herself. She's talking about herself in relation to David. It's like, I am your servant. She's being self-deprecating. No, but she's Nabal's wife.
Lineage. Mm-hmm. I thought the oldest son is who got the wealth.
Yeah. Did he have a son?
Nabal.
Does Nabal have a son?
Yeah.
Oh, I assume if David marries her, though, he's now the head of the estate. I mean, what he's going to do with it later, who knows? And maybe the son will inherit it eventually, but he's not going to inherit it now. And we don't even know if Nabal has a son. At least, as far as I know, he doesn't. It doesn't mention, yeah.
And there's no suspicion laid upon David?
By whom? At the time? At the time? Well, you'll see, right, well, you will see at the time that people are suspicious of David having wiped out Saul's house, and presumably people think that he stepped on a lot of people on his way up to the throne, but it doesn't say anything about Nabal at the moment. And maybe the story was effective or was true. Who knows? I mean, is it impossible that Nabal had a stroke? It's not impossible. So, yeah, people have strokes.
There's no mention in here that Nabal and Abigail had children.
That's what he just asked, yeah. That was what Don just asked.
But
presumably so.
Women could own property back then.
Well, it's not clear whether they could own property back then or what would have happened to the property if David hadn't been there, but it's clear that David takes it over. And who's going to dispute it with him? So he becomes the head of the household, yeah. Yes, that's a really good point, that she could send him all this stuff and Nabal doesn't even know,
yeah.
Speaks to the size of the household. And the fact that the servants came to her and told her what happened maybe speaks to the fact that she has the loyalty of a lot of the household too, because they also think he's a jerk, which would also make it easier for David to take over the household when Abigail marries him. Also because, what's she going to do? She has to have someone. She's not going to manage this huge as a single woman alone sooner or later, and David is a perfect David's there. He is a target of opportunity. So, yeah.
Can we go back to Saul urinating in the cave for just one second?
Sure.
Because, curiously, my translation says that Saul went into the cave to cover his feet. And I'm wondering if the Hebrew says...
That must be a very old translation.
Yeah, it is a very old.
That's why. It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
They don't want to say it literally. That's the only reason. That's the only reason. Yeah, of course I do. Sure I do. It says, and I will tell you, lahasechet raglav. Yes, exactly. That's exactly what it says. Lahasechet raglav means literally to cover his feet, but it means to urinate. So they just translate it literally. Right. You don't have to go into a cave to cover your feet. Right? You can cover your feet outside the cave. But the point is that they don't say... Right. Yes, it is a euphemism. But that's exactly what it says at the bottom. It's very funny. It says at the bottom there. Right. Yes, unless they did, which is also possible. Maybe you did cover your feet when you urinated to protect your... Seriously, to protect your feet. Yeah. Pees against a wall. Right, exactly. Yes. It's a metaphor for men. Right. I don't know. I can't tell you why, but it is an interesting thing, yeah.
Who is the other woman that he marries?
Michal or just the other? No, she's just someone who's mentioned and nothing, we know nothing more about her.
But
he picked her up along the way.
Is Abigail
seriously. Is she his first wife?
Yeah. No.
She's his third wife.
His third wife.
As far as we know. Right. Michal is his first wife.
Yeah.
He avails himself of the privileges of status in the ancient world, which is multiple marriage. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know. So, yes. It seems that way. It seems that way. David ran away. Michal is left alone. And so Saul gives her to someone else. She doesn't want, the same reason, realize how insecure the status was of any woman who was left alone. What was she supposed to do? So if she didn't have grown children who could care for her, and she didn't have a husband, she was in trouble. So that's why Abigail immediately, of course, marries David, and why multiple women are willing to marry a single man if they're wealthy enough to take care of them.
And it doesn't say anything about David going back and reclaiming his wife.
No.
Now that he's kind of done with her.
Yes, he is done with her. Remember with the, right, yeah.
He used what he could get.
Yes, they are not, right. They're not, well, but you'll see later on that he's not, that doesn't mean he's willing to give her up to someone else. even though he's done with her. It will not mean later that he's willing to give her up to someone else because she's still his and he's a possessive man. So he's not happy later that Saul actually gave her away, as you will see, but that doesn't mean that he, you know, that he does it out of love, which is a different question. Yeah.
Is there any indication how old Abigail is?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Yeah.
It's interesting that going back to the cave episode that David pursued Saul out of the cave to deliver his, basically, his suffocated self. So obviously there was an audience there.
Yeah. I think that that's right. I think that's why he doesn't want to say it privately to Saul. He wants everybody to know that he could have killed Saul, but he didn't. Yep.
In the previous chapter, what does Saul mean when he says, "Do not wipe out my name from my father's house"?
In other words, don't kill everybody that's part of my line. You know, don't. When I die, I mean, I have kids, and then I'll have grandkids and so on. Don't erase me from that. And also maybe don't erase me from the history of the people, which, you know, in the ancient world that was often done. Like inscriptions, people would wipe out the name of the king that preceded them and overwrite the inscription with their own name so that nobody would remember who came before.
When the Nabal episode is happening, where's Saul?
Presumably he went back to back home, essentially. I mean, we don't know. It doesn't say. But since he gave Michal away, so he must be back home. Yeah.
In the previous chapter, again, about divination, can you see it as a metaphor that when he went to relieve himself, actually he relieved all of us and everybody from Saul? Because it seems that this is the last of Saul. Mm-hmm. Is it the last of Saul that we see in the Torah?
No. You'll see Saul again.
Yeah.
You will see Saul again in a very dramatic way, actually.
Yeah.
But I don't know. The other possibility about the urination episode is that it's deliberately intended to make Saul look a little foolish and powerless, which it does, you know? So that's also, I mean, it's the downfall of a king. And the worst part of it is that, you know, to look foolish. It's much better to look tragic than to look foolish. There's a little bit of foolishness about this, right? Weak. Yeah.
Talking about David not wanting to kill Saul because Saul is the king, I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, but I read somewhere that Elizabeth I did a little shilly-shallying about killing Mary Queen
right.
of Scots because she didn't want
That's
to
exactly
the
That's exactly why. That's right. Not only to establish the precedent, she was afraid how she would be seen. Because remember, it's one thing for her father, who could kill people right and left, but a king can do that. But she was well aware of how different, because everybody acted so differently, how different it was to be a queen from being a king. So, you know, it's tricky. I mean, the same thing is true to a much lesser extent, but it is still true today. If the president were a woman, you and I both know that different judgments would be rendered in all sorts of ways, good or bad. They just would. It's not like, you know, it's none of us are gender blind. Mm-hmm. We just aren't. And whatever our reactions to someone, their first condition, but it's the first thing that you either know about someone or want to know about somebody. Is this person male or female? Right? That's the first thing that you judge when you meet someone. So it's very hard to erase that kind of distinction, and I have no doubt that it, you know, that it would operate even for all the, you know, more on this another time. But I've been thinking about this in part because I just wrote a review that's going to come out for the Los Angeles Review of Books on a book by an Israeli sociologist named Eve Eluz called "Why Love Hurts," and it's very interesting. I won't tell you about it now. I'll tell you about it another time, or you can read the review. But it's interesting because her contention is that a lot of what we think of as psychological is really sociological. In other words, people say, why can't he commit? And her answer is, it's not because he has some psychological deficit, but because society has gradually been set up in such a way as to minimize commitment, even though we may not be aware of all the mechanisms by which it does that. And there are lots of them. It's a very, very interesting book. Not, by the way, a breezy read. I'm not recommending. It's academic. You have to, like, work your way through it, but it's very interesting. Just read the review. Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, in a novel or news reports, into her regime, I never thought of Golda Meir as a gender.
You never thought of Golda Meir as having gender. Well, she did, and she used her gender.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She used it very, I mean, very self-consciously, she used her gender. Yeah, it's true that she was less gendered than some other people. Well, but that has to do with the way that she presented herself in part, right? She deliberately presented herself as degendered in a way that, for example, someone like Hillary Clinton doesn't. Mm-hmm. But still, people were aware that she was a woman. And she used the woman grandmother thing, you know, in a way that like a male politician couldn't have used grandfather the way she used grandmother. So there still are differences. Okay, and on that note,